Mr. Swan Riedel, too.
I was in charge of guns, and there was another officer who was an assistant to the captain, who was, he was a lieutenant too, but to the captain, who was the troop commander. But it was very interesting, because there were a lot of old soldiers in this particular troop, and they didn't like taking the £25 to bits. They didn't think it could be done. And I let them have a go, made sure they didn't do any damage to the guns. But they wouldn't, or couldn't, get the trail off the axle and the wheels. And they said they couldn't do it. And eventually I said, well, look, give me a brass bit and a hammer, and I'll show you how to do it. And I saw a look of disbelief in some of these people, some of the faces. So I got on my back, and I took the cross pin out, and I moved the castellated nuts with the brass drift, and then I said, no, just let the carriage off the doors, and they took them off. They couldn't believe it. That's all they were. I said, did you want any more? And I put it together today. She brought some more books. I said, just let me know, I'll come and help you. And that was that. Now, the next day, I brought the officer, and we'd been talking to the cook, who was cooking in a field oven, an old sort of 5 gallon petrol can, you know, built in and surrounded by mud and so on. I got one right in the middle of the jungle. And I happened to say to him, I'd love to bully a beef stew. And, all right. So on that particular day, he said, I'm awfully sorry, sir. He said, I did try to make some bully beef stew, but he said, the assistant cook used self-raising flour that looked like porridge. A pink coloured porridge, you know, something like it. But it was very palatable, nonetheless. But the point being that he suddenly said to me, he said, you didn't come straight to us from university, did you, Mr. Swan? He said, you showed those old sweats a thing or two about the guns. They wouldn't believe that could be done. And I said, well, you know, I'm sorry, but I've been a gunner since the beginning of the war, and I knew the 25 pounder. It was simple. And I don't understand. I don't doubt that they have qualms about it, because it's a very fine gun and they didn't want to damage it and left it right there. But no, that's fair. And so we then helped 3 lots of troops, guns from the other 2 troops, and infantry regiments with mules going to Burma from the strongholds at White City and Broadway. And it was on one of those occasions that I was talking to one of the muleteers who couldn't keep his mule still. And for those who are unaware of it, in the first Chinook campaign, the mules were more or less roaming free, and the pilots of the Dakotas had very great job getting down between them to the loo and the back of the tail of the little plane. So this time they divided the width of the plane into 3. In the first part, in putting horizontal beams at about 4 foot and at 2 foot across the fuselage, and then dividing the plane into 3 by longitudinal bamboos, one down the side of the plane, one cutting off a third, one again another third, and then one on the extreme right of the plane, the bamboos. And the idea was to push the mules into the left and the extreme right, leaving the centre free. Now, once the mules were in, the longitudinal bamboos were pulled up and horizontal bamboos were lashed to them, both at the top and lower level, so the mules couldn't kick, otherwise they'd kick a hole in the fuselage. And the pilots were able then to go down the centre channel to look at the back with any fear of being kicked. And it was on one of these occasions that I was talking to one of the muleteers whose mule was being very fractious. Of course, he'd got one of these bushcaps on, didn't see his face really. But he was trying to control me when I was saying a few harsh words to him. And then I finally sort of said to him, say, sort it out. And he looked up at me and I said, oh, Bill Hoskins. We looked together and laughed because I hadn't seen him for, what, 20 years when we were both boys together in a choir in our church in Leicestershire. And we had a good laugh. I've seen him since that old Comrades Association reunion, which was very interesting. And so, having got the last of the troops and guns in, it only remained for us to fulfil our part. And since no one was left behind other than our troop and the infantry going with us, we were moved up to Silhet, which by this time had become the headquarters of the Chindic campaign. And eventually we flew into the stronghold of Blackpool, landed within about 1,500 yards of the Nanquin Road and Railway Station, and our job was to prevent traffic. Traffic getting down south or up north to Stilwell in Michinara. He was trying to take Michinara, still being in charge of the Chinese armies. Now Stilwell didn't like British at all, and that goes without saying. If you read any of the books about the campaign, you'll find this. And Windwick, having been killed just before we went into Burma, we found that the new commander had been persuaded by Stilwell to depart from the principles laid down by Windwick that a stronghold should be in the middle of the jungle, and a clearing in the middle of the jungle where only light mortars or rifles or small machine guns could be got at them. The stronghold would be surrounded by defensive system of wires and so on. And round the stronghold there would be a floater patrol of troops, a floater column they would call them, which would stop you even getting to the stronghold. But the stronghold would be nevertheless able to defend itself under normal circumstances. And that would contain weapons, ammunition and so on for the floater column and for other patrols that may wander in wanting to be having their equipment and so on replaced. And all the other strongholds had followed that principle, but still wanted the road and railway blocking, and Nanquin seemed to be the place where this could take place, because the road and railway would, from aerial surveys, showed them to be running neck and neck, as it were. And there was evidence that the RAF had done a lot of bombing of these particular bridges. And of course the American bulldozers had been in and had cleared the paddy fields of the buns, or the divisions as they are really, which enables the water to flow from high level to bottom level and irrigate the whole area. But the bulldozers came in, the graders, and leveled up the paddy fields, and so the guns and the troops started to arrive. We could only take three guns to begin with in the three Dakotas, and we'd only have 25 rounds of ammunition per gun.
These were 25 pounders?
Yes, these were 25 pounders. There was also a troop of Bofors, but how they got there I don't know, but there were four Bofors for sighting on the hills in the stronghold. And so obviously at Silhet we dismantled the 25 pounders and placed them across the floor of the plain to distribute the load fairly. We've got four men in each gun crew, just sufficient to fire them if necessary, and 25 rounds of ammunition. we set off, we went over the hills between Burma, between India and Burma, saw various fires glowing in the dark, and eventually we landed on this bumpy airstrip, only 1,500 yards from this Roden Railway and a railway station in Nam Quin.
This is early May 1944, would you say?
Yes, this is early May 1944, and we're somewhere about the 12th of May or something like that. 12th of May. And we landed. The Japs were attacking at the time, but the there was some dense scrub, I recall, between the airstrip and the road and fields leading to Nam Quin, and the Japs were attacking sort of round the corner, as it were, from the airstrip. Why? We never knew, because they must have been able to see the Dakota landing in headlights on, if you please. Anyway, we started to unload the plane, and we got to the breech block. Now, the breech block weighs about 200 weight, and it's got the breech, the slider in the breech block, which, when the shell is put in and the charge put in, the number two on the gun pulls the lever and closes the breech so that it can be fired. And we didn't take the breech block out. We took the breech block off, but we didn't take the slider part of the breech out. It's probably a mistake now, in retrospect, because when we got all the other items off, we wanted the breech block. We were being helped by members of the King's Own Regiment, who didn't know one part of the artillery piece from another, apart from their rifles and machine guns. And I said, look, this is extremely heavy. It weighs about 200 or 300 weight. You have to be very, very careful. Because the floor of the Dakota was about 4 foot 6 upwards. And therefore you were taking that weight at chest high. And anyway, we got it to the edge. And I said to these chaps, the four of them trying to help, preach back about sober. And I said, now take the weight. And I said, I'll tell you when it comes. And we got it right here. I said, right, take it now. And one of them let go. The breech block dropped. And my hand went through and the slide of the breech came up and created a gash in my right wrist. You could see the tendons underneath, but it was acting like a sort of... If it hadn't been a wrist, it would be a finger, it would have sheared the finger off, but it didn't. And when I got... When the gun was assembled and taken into the stronghold by the jeeps, which the Americans had supplied, and put into position with the other guns, I went to the MO and just, you know, well, if you want to go out, I said, there's much point that now I'm here. Can it be handled? And he said, yes. So he sprinkled himself with nilamide powder on it and dialed it up, and we carried on. It saw for days, but it didn't incapacitate me. And then about 2 days later, the fourth gun came in, so we were then quite happy with the situation, in that we got the four guns, we got the four gun crew, we got plenty of ammunition. Now, we were not told at that stage precisely where the Japs' guns were, and I had to site a command post. The four guns were slightly on the gun. I had to site a command post, which was in a re-entrant in one of the hills. And what I didn't know was that there were some Japs' guns almost enfilading the valley. And at night time, he opened up with some of his light attack anti-tank guns. And some of the shells whizzed along the floor of this valley. Luckily, we were all right. We didn't suffer any casualties, but it made me realise that I got the command post in the wrong place. So we then moved into a re-entrant, another re-entrant, which was almost at right angles, and there we constructed a very sound command post, covered up with heavy tree trunks, sods of grass and so on. We had the 21 radio set there, and we had the Gurkhas and the Kings in front of us, on the forward slope, so have a look in the airfield. And for some time, of course, the Japs had a go at the perimeter defences and were repulsed with heavy losses. And at that stage, we had the ability to send out wounded. But eventually, towards the end, that facility was no longer available. The Jap began to control the airstrip and the coast could no longer land. But before that, I had one young chap who's a conscript, his first baptism of fire, it were, and he just was shell shocked. He was running about and we got him into the fucking. He was all right, he became available. It was a dicky time, of course, you'd get something like that, it could spread across the rest of the young chaps that were there. And this bombardier chap that I was talking about, the opposition assistant who got the Rangers on, was with me again, and we'd left a very narrow gap between the walls of the earth walls of the command post, where we just get in and out by moving sideways. In other words, a very small hole. And this particular occasion, we had an attack by Jap Zeros and also his 105mm coal scuttle mortar, called coal scuttle. And the bombardier was so keen to see the Zero, he was looking through this narrow gap, and he only got his felt hat on, a bush hat, which they loved, and I said, get back, you never know what's going to happen. And I kept well out of the door, as it were, and suddenly they go, and between us, and I'm talking about a foot gap between us, a jagged piece of mortar fell, which was 7 inches long, we measured it, 7 inches long, about an inch wide, with jagged edges, and it was red hot. And I said to the bombardier, I said, now perhaps you'll believe me, that in a situation like this, wear your steel helmets. And every one of the gun troop after that was wearing a steel helmet. And it proved to be the answer in my case later on. Anyway, we shelled the station, we shelled various targets, and I think there were 12 targets registered on the in that area. We shelled the village of Pinball, where there was a gun that was firing at us. It wasn't a howitzer, it was a gun. It was firing at us from about 5 miles. And we went out, and the troop commander went out, actually, at night to try and locate it, and we fired on a fixed target. But whether we did it, whether we didn't, I don't know. But certainly, it was that we were firing at extreme range. And one had these incidents which one recalled afterwards with a sort of amusement, but which could have been fatal at the time. The 25 pounder is a gun which can be used either as a gun, where the line of flight is comparatively low, or as a howitzer, where you can lob a shell over a hill, and the ranges depend on the line of sight from the gun to the intervening feature, whether it's a hill, a tree, or whatnot. And each gun sergeant is supposed to look at the crest ahead and find what his crest clearance is. In other words, if he was asked to fire the gun at a gun and the tragic truth would be so low that he would hit the top of the hill, he would obviously have to change to a lower charge and love it more as a howitzer. And I'd given instructions for the numbers one, that is the sergeant in charge of each gun, to do this almost as soon as we got in. And I recall the kings who were dug in just below these trees. Suddenly sort of yelling like mad because one of the guns had fired and he hadn't got the crest clearance. Well, he got crest clearance, right, but he'd forgotten just to the left there was a tree which was about 15 foot up above the surface of the hill. And of course he suddenly gone around fire, and of course the shells hit the top of the tree. Showered the kids with branches or something. There was no harm done, you see. But it could have been fatal. The other thing which was queer is the Jap seemed to be working to a timetable. And I had this 21 set, radio set, which is a very powerful set, for receiving and also for giving instructions to the guns, each of which had a tannoy speaker, so that in the height of battle, when things were going on, I could speak clearly to the numbers one. But it came to a pattern where we said, oh, okay, it's what, 5:20 past 5? Okay, stand to, under cover. And the Japs would start shelling the mortars and so on. And probably around about 10 to 6, you'd stop. And there'd be no more activity during the daytime until about the same time at night. So it became a pattern after 20 days we realised this. And what I used to do, we used to put the Calcutta radio news on onto the radio set line and connect the tannoy system up so the men in the gun crew could hear the news. And some of the infantry troops were very pleased to hear this. They'd never had this before. It wasn't very loud, at least they could hear it. And as I say, in the targets we fired at, we were getting some pretty sharp firing, some mortar firing from a hill feature across the river Nanquin, the channel they call it, up there on a hillside. And so we put down about 20 rounds of smoke so that the Japs couldn't more precisely see where we were, they knew roughly where we were. And we called down for strike of the American bombers, and they came down because they knew where we were and they saw where the smoke was. So they just blasted this hillside, and patrols went out after and said there were quite a tremendous number of casualties there because they were very caught on the hop. And then round about the 23rd of May, things got very, very tight indeed, and I was grateful that at some stage in my training at Optio I learnt Urdu, because on the morning of the 25th the Gurkhas came over the top of the hill and said, "Dushman high, sir, Dushman high." And I don't know, one thing, the enemy's there, so they were coming back. And what I didn't know was that their sergeant, an English chap, had got instructions from brigade headquarters to close the block down. So we hadn't time to spike the guns. All we could do was to take all the dial sight and the firing mechanism out and follow them out. I did see the commander of the stronghold ultimately when I was in the hospital, and said, "You know, we were not told. We've got the radio set, we were not told." And I could have been accused of leaving my post, but I said the sergeant was so sure that there was no chance and the Japs were coming thick and fast. Then I said, I thought my opportunity was to save the men. He said, "You did quite right, we just haven't time to notify everybody." I thought, terrible admission that. You've got troops there, you can't tell. But anyway, no harm done, except that in climbing up the hills, the Jap was putting 105 coal scuttles at us, and there was one of the gunners came to me. He got a Bren gun, he got a box of ammunition, he got his own rifle and ammunition for that rifle, and he was just about a yard away to my left, and one of those things that go bang suddenly landed, and he said, "They got me, they got me, Mr. Swan, they got me." And I say now, I'm fairly certain that what he took saved my life, because I got stuff that came carry over the top, and my steel helmet had got about a quarter inch dent in it from some shrapnel or fragment. And I'm certain that had I not had the steel helmet on, that would have gone through the skull, but I'm almost certain that it was on the left side of my head, so I knew it had come from that side. And the other bits that came over the top of this particular poor chap caught my eyes, and that's, I had to get out. I could see, but only by looking right up, because there were hemorrhages right in the eyes. Anyway, I got out, marched out, and that's when I was referring earlier on to a passage in one of the books where Colonel Scott, now Brigadier Scott, in the evacuation, was sitting on a tree trunk, calmly smoking a cigarette, and all hell had been let loose around him. A wonderful calming influence on all the troops that were passing him by. So we marched out, marched 3 days through the jungle, and up hill and down dale. Here I must pay tribute to the West African Brigades, who joined the monsoon period, which had broken, of course. It would be impossible to have got up the hills, and I tell you that the final hill we got to was about 3,700 feet. They revetted these slopes, in other words, cut steps in them, and put bamboo treads in so that everybody could get themselves back without slipping back, and that was invaluable for the mules, of course. So we reached Moxo, which was the hill feature above the massive Indormi Lake, which can be seen in any map of northern Burma. And we were short of food. In fact, my emergency ration, was like aero chocolate, reinforced, I suppose. I had on the second day, because we had no food, and that was shared out between 8 men, and we felt reasonably happy we had something. But we got to the hilltop, and we had a free drop by Dakotas of bullock carcasses, and they were roasted open fire, barbecue fashion, and that set us up for the march downhill to Moxo Sakan, which was the village on the edge of the lake in Dormi. And we were in Bashers, the coconut palm huts, Bashers they called it, where we stayed for 2 days, 2 days really. And I was classed as a high category for evacuation.
Because of the damage to your eyes?
The damage to both eyes. And the net result was, My batman had just come to see me, and said, "Mr. Swan," he said, "have you got any knives?" And he said, "you had some more oxen, and we haven't any knives to cut the stuff with." And I had